Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today I'm at the International Culinary Center with Clayton Miller, who is a Food & Wine magazine Best New Chef of 2010. He also was got the Rising Star Chef Award from Star Chefs, and he was up for Best New Restaurant for Yardbird Southern Bar and Table, Table and Bar.
Well, that's a little clarification on that one. They actually, that's true, but it's funny when you hear, actually. I was up for that award at another restaurant, actually, restaurant called Trummers on Main in Virginia. But Yardbird also actually got it as well. We kind of did it separately, and now we've come together. So.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so it's true. Right?
Well, hello and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
My gosh, it's great to have you here. I have to admit, I haven't eaten at Yardbird, mm-hmm. but I'm intrigued by it. I've read a lot about it. So, but before we get to Yardbird, let's talk about you.
Okay.
So here you are, Southern Bar and Table, and you're a boy from Pittsburgh.
Yeah, born and raised up north, but I think I've spent definitely enough time in the South to call myself a Southerner at this point. I want to say all but maybe 2 years of my career has been in the South. There was a stint in New York City for a year, and I spent...
I'll come back, but
going to New York for 1 year and a little time in California, and then the rest has been in the South.
In the South. Okay, well, we'll get to why you did that. But tell me about Pittsburgh. How long were you there? Did you go through your high school?
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, I grew up there until, you know, I finally left town essentially to go off to college, you know, so my formative years were there. It's a great town. I mean, small town. It's definitely changed over the years, but I'm very happy to have come from there.
So what were your interests in high school?
Like every other typical kid. You know, sports. I grew up playing, you know, soccer year round.
And soccer?
Yeah, that was from very early age. All the way through college. So it consumed most of my growing up time. And so, like, outside of that, I was a fairly, you know, typical kind of teenager and young boy. So.
So when you were about 18 in Pittsburgh, what were you dreaming of? Other than girls.
Yeah, as I say, watch what you ask. Would you really? Probably a lot of typical, you know, 18-year-olds, there's a lot of things going through your head because you're no longer, all of a sudden you're starting to come to a realization of that you know you're going to have to fend for yourself soon, you know, and you're not going to be able to rely on mom and dad anymore. And so as we're all, you know, entering our senior year or finishing up our senior year of high school, you know, I'm essentially looking around, and as everyone is going, oh, I guess I'm going to go get a business degree, right? Isn't that what you're supposed to do? Or liberal arts, or do something like that. And I was lucky enough at that point to kind of, I was going off to get a college degree, but I knew enough of what I was interested in to go into hotel and restaurant. Degree.
So you knew that then?
Yeah, but it wasn't like this huge, like, I mean, I've been asked in the past, like, oh, what took you into cooking and all that stuff, and I hate to say it, I have no romantic story of, you know, cleaning a rabbit when I'm 5 with my grandfather, or making gnocchi with my grandmother when I'm 8, you know,
yeah.
I really don't. I mean, it was something that I got lucky. It's that simple. I said, you know, like I said, I kind of went off to school, went, I kind of think that's what I want to do. Did the college thing, graduated, and then I kind of went, it was still even up in the air, kind of like, going, I don't know, hotels or restaurants? And I guess restaurants, kind of. I mean, literally that much. And this is literally as all my buddies that I grew up with are all going off to law school, and they're all going off to get their MBAs, And what I decided to do, I said, well, I guess if I'm going to be in restaurants, I need to know a little bit about cooking at least, you know. And so I decided to go to culinary school. And it's literally that simple. Like, it just stuck. Like, as soon as I went to there, went to start cooking, I never looked back. I mean, it never was a doubt in my mind of what... I shouldn't say never a doubt. I mean, there was obviously in any young cook's career, you kind of maybe question what you're going because of the income and the hours and the things like that, and all the other friends that went off to be lawyers and go into business that are making tons of money. You did look back on things like that when you're younger.
How much money did you make in your first job out of school?
I'm trying to remember which one it would have been. Out of school, I started working for Ritz-Carlton, it was $7.25 an hour.
What do you think about that? I think a lot of people are put off getting into the profession because of the starting wages being so low.
I mean, I'm not going to glamorize it or anything and go with the old adage, I did it, so everyone else should have to do it kind of thing. But obviously anyone who has been through it will tell you it definitely toughens you and it weeds out the ones that don't belong for various reasons, you know, and there's good and bad to that. I mean, I like one, and I don't count this bad because I'm recently married in the last year and a half, and, you know, I'm 42 years old. So you kind of can figure out what I mean by that. So if for my younger part of my adult life, if I would have met the right person back then, would have my, you know, my career path changed because of my income?
Right.
And I saw a lot of my friends that I was in the kitchens with that were, you know, had just as much passion as I did, that just, you know, wanted it just as much, but all of a sudden they meet the right girl or the right guy or whatever, and all of a sudden that right girl all of a sudden becomes, as a, you know, you become pregnant, and then there's kids, and there's things.
Right.
And all those things are wonderful things in life, absolutely, but you saw people kind of, that affected their career, whether it was because of your income or the hours worked and so on. It definitely ate up a lot of talented people that, you know, had to make the change and do something else in their life, which there's nothing wrong with that at all, but I definitely saw the way it affected a lot of young cooks.
So there's a lot of challenges in being a cook.
Absolutely.
And it, with not just learning technique.
No, without even, tell you what, forget about even what kitchen you go into right now, but yeah, that sacrifice you have to put in.
How long does that take?
Everyone's a little different. I've seen some people that don't spend very long, you know, working in the kitchens as a cook, and they jump into, you know, upper level management positions, or they get their own kitchen or whatever, and they become successful. There's those people that are out there. There's those people in any line of work that are very talented. They get lucky. They get, you know, whatever. They're at the right place at the right time, and they execute on it. So that happens in all walks of life. But generally speaking, to answer the question is, for me, it took over 10 years before I ever stepped up into a management / whatever you want to call it, chef position. So
why did it take that long? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
For me, I think it was a good thing. Yeah, for me, it definitely was. Because I can
spend 10 years preparing.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I didn't set out, you know, 10 years prior and go, you know what, on my 10th year, I'm going to go get that, you know, move up in the world of cooking and get a job. I think it was just a natural progression and over time. And I definitely remember a couple clear, distinctive times in my career where I said, matter of fact, when I was moving to New York City, that I said, okay, I'm going to do this one more. And I'm going to go and work for one more guy. And I came to New York, and that's actually where I started working for Danielle. And then when I left a year later, I went back to my former chef at the time or whatever, and I ended up with another opportunity. I'm like, no, you got to, let's do one more. And so.
Let me get into that mentality, because, you know, I haven't explored this with many people on this show. So you decide on a culinary career, you graduate from culinary school, you get in your first culinary job, the pay is awful, hours are long, but a lot of people do it because they love it, and the camaraderie of the kitchen. But, you know, now you start doing your journeyman, you go to different kitchens. and you said 1 year at Danielle, 1 year, and I'll do one more. What is that mentality? What are you learning, and why is it 1 year? What happens in those middle years, 2 years out of school, but before you are Clayton Miller?
I think it's a combination of things. Meaning it's kind of like signing up for a tour. You know, you came back from doing your tour, and then you're like, okay. And when you're going through it, you're like, this is the last one. And then you finish it, and you're like, okay, I can do one more. You know, like, yeah, I can re-up one more kind of thing. And because each time you're doing it, too, I mean, for as hard as they are, and you're moving all over the country or whatever, I mean, hell, starting any new job is hard. But when you're moving, commuting, and you're single, you don't have money, and you're moving across the country, and you're moving to New York, you're moving to California, you know, it's a stressful thing. But still, you know, you're walking away
stronger.
What are
you looking for in the new one? What's the hook? What is it that when you leave the old one, you miss? And what's the lure?
I think the biggest lure of the new one was knowledge. For me, it was.
So you had to know the chef that you were going to.
Yeah, knowledge, and I don't know if this is an egotistical side, just saying that I did it. I mean, just to say it was kind of like an accomplishment. It was one more feather in my cap, one more, kind of.
So Danielle and the French Laundry.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, you can't get bigger than that.
No, and you know what's funny about the French Laundry, and I hate to say this, French Laundry is over 10 years ago now at this point for me. French Laundry was really the last place I served as a quote-unquote line chef, or line cook, excuse me. I'm doing the work in the meat station or garmanche station. Of course, I've worked stations here and there from when a cook calls out or what have you, you know. But that was really the last place that I was, you know, a line cook. And I've always thought of it because at that point in my career, I had been cooking for, I don't remember exactly, you know, 9, 10 years, whatever. So it wasn't like I was a newbie to the business, and I'd been through some really good kitchens at that point. And but you know, French Laundry to me always was a great, not that we're ever finished or done, but it was just like a great place to round out a career or the beginning of a career.
I kind of want to explore more of that with you. You know, you would think you have 2 3-star Michelin restaurants, Danielle and French Laundry, and all the kitchens are set up with garde manger, you know, mm-hmm. fish station, meat station, whatever. How different are kitchens if you're going to like re-up and want to get more knowledge? Is it the chef's menu that you're going there for, or the technique, or when you say French Laundry rounding you out? I don't understand. Explain it to us who don't.
Well, I mean,
aren't on the inside there.
Well, it is any cook that's been around the block a few times. Well, absolutely, and in good places, you know that. And these days, there's more and more good places because there's so many. You know, look at what you do here. I mean, the talent level now is so much bigger than it was 10, 15 years ago. But you know, the difference absolutely is. I mean, the way that Danielle cooks a sunchoke versus the way Thomas does, it's like, I hate to say it, there are differences to it. It's not drastically different. You're not going to sit there and be blown away by it and so on. But there's small differences, and then you add 2 or 3 other chefs' techniques in there. And then all of a sudden, out the other side, you know, Clay Miller is squirted out the other side of all of those experiences, and then my own ideas that I take from the good and the bad. Because believe it or not, there are bad things in some of these places too.
I was going to say, how many bad techniques do you pick up, or bad habits?
It's habits probably more than anything else, and the thing I struggled with, or not struggled with, one of the things I saw some of the kitchens struggling with throughout my time. And it goes without saying, again, this is nothing really hard to figure out. The larger the kitchen, the more difficult the discipline was. You know, the really true cooking, or not true cooking, some of the best cooking that I've ever seen in my career was in the smaller kitchens. Because, you know, as I use French Laundry kind of as, not my finishing school, but, you know, I really learned a lot about cooking prior to getting there. And I was working for a guy named Joel Antonez in Atlanta at the Ritz-Carlton Buckhead. And that guy, you know, the things I learned from him, and because he was there every day, you know, and he personally was coming to his first time in America, and so he really had a lot to prove.
Where was he coming from?
He was coming from, at that time, I think, London. I believe, at the time. And he had, I think, gotten one or two Michelin star there, and then for something happened, his restaurant closed. But so, and then Ritz-Carlton went on and recruited him, because the whole, real quick backing up, is the whole story at Ritz-Carlton at that, back in that day and age, and this is the mid-90s, Gunther Seeger was at...
Maybe not as well as you know. I've eaten at the Ritz-Carlton in those days.
I'll hold my tongue on it. No, Gunther is a unique individual, and I still, without a doubt, still to this day, he influences my cooking. There's some other things I'll just say without going into it. I disagree with some of his style. Anyways, but I'm going further than I wanted to on that. No, so he was there at the Ritz-Carlton. We had just been awarded Ritz-Carlton's first mobile five-star award. And so Atlanta at that time, meaning the Ritz-Carlton Bucket, that was their showpiece. That was their, like, number one restaurant in the company, in the United States. And so, and headquarters was there. It was attached to it. How do I put it? Money was no object, essentially. So we were doing some really great things. And back then, there was only, I think there was 12 or 13 mobile five-star restaurants in North America. And so it was a very special place to be in. And you're one of, at that time, 10 cooks in the kitchen. And when he left to go do his own place, I at least, and a few of the other guys, had at least enough intelligence to say, you know what, we can go with him. Which wouldn't be bad, I'm not saying that, but it was like, or you can stay here, keep your same job that you have right now, and they've got to bring in some heavy hitter. They have to. They don't have any choice. You know, it's going to be someone big, you know, that's going to come in here. So they went out and found this guy, newcomer to the States, and he kept the five stars this whole time through it, and he was, I forget what year, he was James Beard, but... In any case, he came to the States and he had something to prove, and he was in the restaurant every day. That was the beauty of working for him. So you're working for this crazy French guy in his late 30s trying to prove to America that he's the best chef in America, and he's pushing the gamut every single day, and the menu's changing every single day.
We're going to take a short break, but I want to come back and revisit your journey through the South and
sure.
this restaurant.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef. Pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Today, I'm interviewing Clay Miller, who's the executive chef of Yardbird Southern Bar and Table. And we were just talking about the various kitchens and how they influenced his cooking. But I want to know your Southern, as you said, you feel more Southern. You may have been born in Pittsburgh. Most of your cooking adult life has been in the South. So let's start with the journey. How did you first get down there, and what opened your eyes about Southern cooking?
Down to Yardbird specifically, or?
Well, we're going to get to Yardbird. Yeah, and how did it come to influence your menu at Yardbird today? But I want to go the long, slow route. I want to understand how this simmered along.
Well, let's see. So. After spending some time in Atlanta for, about 3-4 years at that point, and seeing what was going on around in Atlanta, and at that time, Atlanta was really starting to grow. A lot of good chefs were starting to do some things there, and so there was a really good culinary vibe in Atlanta. But this is kind of where I took a small detour from my Southern roots, and this is where my chef was able to secure me a job at Danielle in New York. and I came up to New York.
So you were in Atlanta.
Right out of school, went down to Atlanta and spent about 4 years there.
4 years. And then how did your chef send you to Danielle? Did he say it's time for you to go
I was looking. It was a mutual thing. I was kind of like, hey, okay, I've been here for working for you for about a year and a half or so. I can't recall. Maybe it was even a little longer than that. And, he often spoke about how he would personally knew Danielle and Jean-Georges and all the big names, and half of which I don't know was true or not, but he sure talked the game that he knew all these guys. And you know, and back then it was Greg Kuntz was the other big one, and so I was like, hey, do you ever think you could get me there? And so, and it was that simple. I mean, he picked up the, and turned out he did know some of them, so he literally called Danielle, or I guess back then was it Alex Lee?
Alex Lee, yeah.
Yeah, was still the chef de cuisine back then, and he talked to him, and essentially it was like, okay, good. This is actually a pretty good story, because so I'm told I have a job at Danielle. I say, fantastic. I do all the proper things. I put in a whatever, 3-week notice, 4-week notice. I go and find a place to, I'm going to find a place to live. I do all this. I'm literally moving to New York City for the first time in my life. Been in New York once, you know, before that. And luckily I had a friend here that I grew up with, one of those guys that went off and got their MBA and were making lots of money in New York. So I was lucky enough that I had a place to stay, and that was a really good thing. But so, anyways, the funny story is that I show up on the back, employee entrance of Danielle's kitchen, knock on the door, I ask for Alex. Alex, finally comes out and gets me. For anyone who's ever been in Danielle's kitchen, he's got the, whatever they call it, the crow's nest or whatever.
The sky box.
And Alex asked me to come up there. I've never met Danielle yet. And he was very nice at first. You know, he was like, okay, hi, how you doing? I'm like, hey, chef, nice to meet you. And then they asked me to wait downstairs in the kitchen. So I'm standing there. And I basically hear them arguing amongst each other, like, where the F are you going to put this guy? We don't have a position for him. I don't know why you took him. And he's like, well, come on, you said that you knew Joelle from it. And they're going back and forth. I literally have picked up my entire life and moved to New York City. And thinking of what I had a job.
Wow.
And they're going back and forth, back and forth. And
how to make you feel real good.
Yeah, I mean, I was 25, I think, or something. I can't remember. So I was still pretty young and a little naive. So I was getting pretty nervous. So anyways, so the story gets better. So that second, of all people, George Perrier walks through the door. He's in town doing something. I have no idea what. And
from Philadelphia.
Yeah, from Philadelphia.
And you know him because you're a Pennsylvanian. And
well, he knew me because of Joelle through a whole nother thing. We did a dinner together. We did whatever. So
So for our listeners, George Perrier has Le Bec Fin in Philadelphia. Such a revered restaurant, they named a street after George Perrier. So
yeah,
and
legendary.
He's quite a character. So
yeah, well,
very
this
classic French chef.
This character got me a job. Because what
happened?
Yeah, because he walks in the door. He's, Danielle and he are yucking it up in French, back and forth, back and forth. And I just somehow, for whatever, and got my enough gumption up and like, Chef Perrier, I'm Clay Miller. I met you at Joelle's. And he's, oh my God, you're from Joelle's? Joelle, he's the best chef in there. Oh my God, he's incredible. Danielle, you hired this guy? He comes from such a great kitchen. Danielle, I swear to you, he may not tell you this story or remember this, but he's like, oh, yeah, you start today. And I swear to you, that's a trip. Like, and even Alex Lee's looking at me kind of like, holy shit, you got to be kidding me. Like, all right, good for you, kid. You're
so
hired.
Where did they put you?
I was entremet TA for Fish Station. The story goes, though, to be quite honest with you, I didn't last at Danielle's. I quit after 4 months.
Why?
Because I came from this other kitchen, what I was speaking about before, this smaller kitchen. Back in the day, Danielle, that was in its newer stages. There had only been open about 6 months or whatever, and it was a tough, tough kitchen.
He runs a tight, tough kitchen. Well, he runs a very hard. I mean, there's a lot of testosterone in that kitchen.
Well, back then, I think, honestly, and I totally understand it now. It's like, back then, I think he was still trying to get his arms around it because it was a big event, venture from where he had come from. And so those just some things that I moved all the way to New York and I just didn't, I don't know, I wasn't feeling that kitchen. I talked with Alex about it, and he and I, they asked me to stay on, and we I tried it for a little bit more, and I eventually came to the part where I said, look, I'll give you as much time as you want, but I need to move on. And I had a very good relationship with Alex. Alex was very graceful about it. He even said if I needed to, make some calls for me or whatever, he just knew it wasn't a good fit.
Right.
And so I moved on, and that happens.
Where did you go from there?
I was lucky enough to land with Floyd Cardoz.
Oh.
Over at Tabla.
Uh-huh.
And I finished out my year in New York at Tabla, so, uh-huh. Which was...
How did you make that connection, and why Tabla?
Again, I hate to say going back to Joel, but there was a connection between Joel, Greg Kuntz, and then Greg Kuntz and Floyd, worked together. I think Le Panas, Floyd was Gray's Sue, I believe, back in those days. And then funny, I mean, the small world and all that stuff, and the whole family and fraternity of cooks and so on, and especially back then, and I'm sure it is still here today, but the fraternity of French chefs in New York and so on. So I landed in with him, and I got to say this about Floyd. He's got to be by far one of the nicest individuals I've ever worked for. I mean, back then, and I was such a... I was such an arrogant dickhead. I thought I was the best thing around, and I got into that kitchen. I walked right in, and I was hired to be the tournade for the kitchen. And so I was, part of my job was to kind of, one, to work all the stations and help train people and what have you. And so I was kind of the lead guy in the kitchen. And I, like I said, I acted that way. And Floyd, I don't know, he kept me in check, but did it in a way that it wasn't deflating to me. And many years later, I kind of looked back, and it was about 4 or 5 years now, I don't know, whatever, several years later, he came in and he ate at a restaurant that I finally was an executive chef at. And I was like, one of the first things I said to him, I was like, I probably owe you probably more apologies than any cook before. And he just started laughing. He's like, are you kidding? Like, he just started laughing. So... So I finished out my time with Floyd and really enjoyed that time there, because I made a lot of good friends there, still guys that I'm in touch with today, and this is over 10 years ago, and whenever I see Floyd, I still, obviously I still have a good relationship with him, and it was just good to see that slightly different cuisine, really taking some other ingredients and things that, even though it was very...
So I'm sitting here, and we've talked about French Laundry, and we talked about Danielle, we've got... Tabla, which is Indian, modern day interpretation of India from Floyd. Where did you get your southern cooking?
It's coming. That's coming.
All right.
It's coming. So I basically, after New York, went back down to Atlanta. I'll kind of speed things a little far. I went back down to Atlanta again. Believe it or not, I've moved to Atlanta at this point, I think, 4 times in my life. Anyways, moved back down to Atlanta, did another year with the Ritz-Carlton, went out to the Laundry, came back. And my first executive chef position, chef de cuisine position, was with Gunther Seeger, the circle of life.
Oh, so you went to his restaurant?
Yeah, many years. This is many years later. And this was definitely a pivotal time in my life, because this is the first and only job I've ever been fired from. I was fired after 4 months of being, 4 or 5 months, whatever it was, I don't remember. And it was kind of a mutual firing, how we'll put it that way. We just did not get along at all, and he, like I said, it was kind of in a way you got yourself fired, So it wasn't a complete shocking thing, but again, it was still a traumatic time in my career. That feeling of having, essentially no income. I know everyone, a lot of people experience that, but it was the first time in my adult life, and so it's something that lives with me still this day.
So you had a disagreement.
Multiple disagreements.
Yeah, okay. So can't you, as a chef, just pick up and go to the next restaurant?
You can try. I mean, it took me about 3 months to find a job. I mean, I literally was the classic 26, 27. No, I was a little older than that. I was probably about 28, 29, something like that. And, I had to go live with mom and dad for a month or two because while I looked for a job. And this is where a little bit more of my southern kind of came into. I had a guy give me a call who probably was one of my, probably one of my mentors, but what I learned from him is more than cooking. It was the business side of the restaurant business, and his name was Carl Brueggemeyer. Carl was a old school restaurant guy. I mean, he was, he, you know, ran Commander's Palace. He ran Tavern on the Green with Warner. I mean, this
guy,
these
are like Cecil B. DeMille.
Yeah, like, you know, the type of guy that, like, you know, smoked two packs a day and drank, you know, 2 gallons of coffee and could run a, you know, $20 million restaurant out of a broom closet and write his business plan on a napkin, you know, and but just that old school gritty kind of guy. And in any case, he gave me a call, and at the time he was the business partner with Norman Van Aken. Norman's down in Miami. And they were in the process of growing their business, and they had a deal again with Ritz-Carlton to do Norman's in Orlando. And my resume kind of came around their way. I'm not even sure how it actually got down there. I think it was honestly through a purveyor, actually. By the way, for any young cooks, you want a great networking tool. Purveyors, purveyors, purveyors.
Yeah.
It's gotten me multiple jobs, you know. So anyway, so I ended up, you know, fast forwarding a little bit, I ended up getting the job with Norman, and I went down to Florida, and I opened Norman's Orlando as the chef de cuisine and whatever slash executive chef, and was there for about 6-7 years, and you know, so I was, and the cuisine there over time changed a little bit, but essentially it was Norman's food, and so I was immersed into his world of cuisine for those number of years.
That was Caribbean. What was it?
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of got I don't want to say all over the place. It's not that at all, but it's definitely got a lot of influences from around the world, mostly, you know, from the islands, South America,
Florida, yeah.
South Florida, even Southern. You know, America, you know, all along the panhandle and so on. And so a lot of, you know, African influences as well because of the, you know, all the cuisine that comes from the islands and so on. So there's a big mix of different ingredients, different way of looking at some food and so on, the way they do, you know, that is simple. I'm trying to think of something really simple that, you know, the use of rice and beans. I mean, come on, everyone uses rice and beans, but, you know, they do it a little bit different and so on. So I was definitely exposed to a lot of different things during my time there. Also during that time frame, because Orlando wasn't the main flagship restaurant for the Norman Van Aken's company at the time, I was often left by myself, if you will, like, to run the business. Not in a bad way, but just, you know, I was in charge of running that business while they were headquartered in Miami, and so that put me in the forefront of learning a lot about the other things of the business, of being respected. And by the time I left there, I was actually directing manager of the whole property, so I oversaw the front of the house, back of the house, and so I was exposed to a lot more things that most chefs don't.
How many years outside of school are you now?
At this point, I got the job when I was 32, left there when I was whatever, I guess about 38, something like that.
So this is the real maturing of a chef that you have to go through.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these, a lot of different kitchens to see different styles, learn different.
If you really, at this point, if you really think about it, by the time I got this is really essentially my first executive position. Because I don't really count Seeger's, that wasn't much of a tour there. But so, and I'm age 32, and basically been waiting for this job since, if you count college, 13, 14 years before I got my first executive. And that's a combination of education and experience through all of that before I did it. And, you know, like I say, and then I was still an employee. I was just an executive chef there. I wasn't Clay's or anything like that. So after a number of years there, I had an opportunity to finally take my first chance at ownership.
Now, we're going to take a break here. And we'll get into, that's a very big step for sure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today our chef is Chef Clay Miller, who is the executive chef at Yardbird Southern Bar and Table. And in Miami, I should point that out.
Yeah,
I know we have listeners in 200 countries, so Miami, Miami Beach or Miami?
Yes, South Beach.
South Beach.
Yeah.
As I said, I'm still waiting to go down there this winter.
You wait till you see this.
I can't wait. Okay, let's get into your first step of ownership, and now we're gonna move
yeah on. This is so I found an opportunity to become not only executive chef but owner, and more importantly for me, outside of even the ownership, I was the chef. There was no other, and this is, I don't mean this in a negative at all, there was no Norman Van Aken, there was no Gunther Seeger, there was no Thomas Keller. There was Clay Miller, and that was it as far as from the cooking side.
So you had carte blanche to do what
yeah,
you wanted.
This is finally...
You run the ship your way.
Yeah, and like I said, you really look at it at this point, I'm pushing the age of, I'm like 38, that it finally took me to do all this. And so I ended up at a restaurant with a group called Trummers on Main in Clifton, Virginia. And we're just outside of D.C. We're about, say, 25 minutes outside of D.C. in Northern Virginia. And it was a family, the Trummers. They had bought a piece of property in this small little sleepy town that they were gutting it, renovating in this really old historic building. It looks like, honestly, this little town looks like some out of, like, Norman Rockwell, because it's, like, all around, it's this oasis in the middle of all this population, because all around it is just tons of population and growth and so on, but it was preserved because of all the historical importance due to the Civil War and things like that. It was the first train stop outside of D.C. and all this, like, important stuff, so it was left intact. So they had this building there, and they were gutting it, and they needed a chef and to help them with it and help run it and so on, and so I took a chance and moved north. Left Norman's and helped them, you know, create this place and this business. And we opened in 2009, the summer of 2009. And this was probably one of the, I don't know, most memorable parts of my career was in 2010. I don't know, 6-7 months after opening, I get a phone call. I remember still this day, I was searing short ribs. And someone says, you know, chef phone. And, you know, one of those, like, oh, son of a bitch. Because I got four pans going, searing, you know, thing. I'm like, all right, fine, I'll be there. And they also said, they didn't say who it was. But I walk up to the phone, and there's a whatever caller ID on it. And it says American Express on it. And I have an American Express, so I didn't think anything of it. I'm just like... All right, geez, I know I'm up to date on my bill. I don't know. And so I answered the phone, and the voice on the other line said, you know, hi, Clay, it's Dana from Food and Wine. And again, I'm like, so what?
Yeah, Dana, go.
yeah, you know, and sure enough, it was Dana Cohen, and, you know, she quickly said, you know, do you have a second? I'm like, of course. It's still really not hitting into me what's about to happen. Because I remember even for a split second, I'm thinking it's one of my buddies messing with me, like got their wife or girlfriend on the phone, because they've done that to me in the past. And I'm still thinking that way, and still kind of, and she goes, well, listen, I want to let you know you're selected as one of America's best new chefs for 2010. And I'm still like going, sure, whatever. And then I'm like,
For Trummers?
This is at Trummers on Main.
Trummers, yeah. So it wasn't for
Norman's. No.
Oh, this okay. Had you been at Trummers?
That's a 7 months we opened.
Wow.
And so in the first 7 months.
To really, for them to pick you on such a short time to do your menu and get your team and
everything. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, wow. I was very, I'm very proud of this to this day. And
yeah.
So it was just a really big deal to me. My first time out, you know, I'm age 38 before anyone's even heard my name before. You
so
know.
What kind of food were you doing?
I couldn't come up with any good description, so I came up with a very original term, modern American. You know, I couldn't, it was the best way
that
I could.
What was your menu like?
It was a little bit all over the place, not too bad. I mean, it was definitely just, always describe the food, at least there, as American is probably the biggest thing, you know. With I wanted approachable food. I wanted food and flavor that people understood, but done slightly different. You weren't going to be shocked by it when you got it, but in the same time, you were still going to be able to identify with it, that the flavors, I'm trying to think back, you know, simple pairings that everyone does, but like, whether you're putting goat cheese and beets together, you're putting mint and lamb together, you're doing, you know, nothing classic things, but done in a different way, but people can understand it because they're classic flavors. So that was kind of like the food. We weren't doing tasting menus. We weren't doing, you know, like the average check was, you know, probably $40.
So this is the first time you really get to do it your way, yeah. And 7 months later, you picked as one of the best new chefs in America. You gotta be on cloud nine.
Yeah, it was. It took some time to set in. It really did.
And then, how did you get to Yardbird? Because we're actually I can't believe we're almost through.
I spent about 3 years with Tremors. There was a good experience. They're a good family. I still consider them my friends. We decided we had a different view on business. I'll leave it at that. But that being said, they're dear friends to me. And I decided to take a chance. A friend of mine, actually my pastry chef from Tremors, had moved on and started working for the Michael Mina Group at Four Seasons Baltimore. I ended up there for a year as the executive chef of the property. And then so here comes Yardbird. All right, so early May, I did an event in Atlanta, the Atlanta Food and Wine Festival, and I run into who's my boss right now, Eddie Sacito, I just run into him in the lobby of the hotel. Turns out he's the chief operating officer for 50X. And we worked together under Norman Van Aken many years earlier. He was the general manager, I was the executive chef and directing manager, and at one time or another, we kind of played around and talked about, oh, one of these days we'll do a business together kind of thing. I went off to Virginia, he went his way, I went my way, whatever. Many years later, we bump into each other in the middle of a lobby at a food and wine convention, and so we just started talking, and we hit it off right where we left off from. And, you know, I said, you know, I'm up in Baltimore right now. It's a job for me, but I'm really interested in looking to get back down south. I miss Florida. Matter of fact, my wife was from Florida, and those multiple reasons. I really grew to love Florida, and I really wanted to get back down there, whether that was to Orlando or Miami or Tampa, anywhere. I just wanted to get back down there. And he's like, well, you know, funny you should say that. We got some things going right now. And he started talking to me about Yardbird and said that we're possibly looking for a new chef. And I said, well, great, you know, let's talk. And I had a couple other things in the fire at the time. But, you know, Eddie and I, like I said, because of our past connection, we just clicked. A month later, I'm moving to Florida, you know, and that's now, it's been 8 weeks that I've been down there.
So what's the menu like?
There's a lot of, I'm still in the process of changing a lot of the food over from the, you know, I'm obviously not the opening chef. The opening chef had decided to move on to try something new. You know, a lot of they did a really good job for the first 2 years there and really turned it into a great business. And I'm in the process of trying to put my mark on the menu. But it is Southern fare, and, you know, I mean, probably we sell the hell out of some fried chicken. I mean,
how do you do the fried chicken?
Oh, fried chicken.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's the best thing, when done well, is the best thing in the world.
No, it is.
No,
it's satisfying to your soul. I mean, that's why everyone loves it so much. Yeah. And it's not a hard thing to make, but when you're cooking 2,000 pounds of it a week, it becomes challenging in a small kitchen.
What kind of oil?
We actually use lard for it. Yeah.
Ooh.
So, which were, you know, great debate on that one. Which one's worse for you, lard or you know, the classic fry on that everyone else does? The great debate of which one's healthier and so on. So,
I think when you're eating fried chicken, you don't think
it is. It's one of those things. Yeah, exactly. You're not, when you're eating a piece of foie gras, you're not asking for skim foie gras. You know, you're going for foie gras. Anyways, yeah, no, they had this restaurant. I keep waiting to bring a visiting chef into my kitchen and just not see his eyes pop out of his head. because when you see the size of this kitchen and then you start hearing the numbers that we do, you know, we're...
So tell me the numbers.
We receive chicken 4 to 5 times a week at a pace of 400 pounds of delivery. We have a walk-in cooler that's smaller than your office. For those of you who aren't here, well, I won't give away your dimensions of your office.
You mean the closet?
Yeah, the closet. And so that's a real challenge, but they, you know, as I walked into the picture, the team had already kind of established a lot of protocols and things to make that happen. They have a pressure deep fryer that's got this thing down to a science, so it's consistent every single time. You know, it's 14 minutes. You get the same product the same time because it's spec'd out at the same thing. The brine's done the same way, and so on. So it's this machine. It's a real formula to it to create something that's so consistent. And then to the other food, you know, and what's funny too, that's probably like 30-40% of our sales is fried chicken. I mean, people obviously just come for that. The rest of the menu is a spinoff of classic Southern fare, you know, just with some twists and turns from other parts of the country and so on. But definitely some Southern fare, and we're trying with also kind of that modern touch on it too. You know, trying, and I'm so new to the property. I'm still doing a lot of my research, still trying to develop things.
Who's your customer? Are they tourists?
Question.
Or are they locals? Or
good question. I mean, my understanding when the place opened up, which I was not there for, it was a lot more local, a lot more people around the beach and a little bit further out, a little further north up into, you know, Fort Lauderdale and so on. But as it grew, the tourists, we're probably pushing 50-50. Right now, and it's such a strange, unique, and when I say strange, I mean in a good way, like where your latest, your pop in the night, like your push in the middle of service isn't 8 o'clock, it's 10:30.
Wow.
You know, it's like you're cruising along, you've already been through service for 5 hours or whatever it is, and you've already done 400 covers, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh boy, we just sat the dining room again, and it's 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and your board goes from 2 tickets to 30 tickets. And it's religiously like that. I mean, it's just nonstop. And it's because of the type of customer. You get the locals that come in early that are here, that know us, we know them, and so on. And then you get a lot that later crowd that's all on vacation. They don't care if tomorrow's Tuesday. They're here to have fun,
right?
You know, and so we're here to provide that for them. So it makes a great dynamic of customer, which allows us to do a good business.
Well, thank you. I can't. 45 minutes just flew by.
Yeah.
It's really nice to have you here.
Thank you for
having
me.
We haven't met before. This has really been fascinating. I appreciate it. I can't wait to get my teeth into that fried chicken.
Yeah, looking forward to having you down.
Okay. Oh, cool there. So you're at the Southern Food and Wine, I mean, not the Southern, but the New York Food and Wine Festival.
Yep.
This weekend.
Yeah, we have a couple events.
Where are you doing the events?
We're over at Pier 17, I believe. Mm-hmm. We're doing the fried chicken coop. I believe myself and a handful of other chefs from around New York and a few other, we're all going to be kind of...
Did you bring your lard?
No, we didn't bring that. We're going to have to...
Sources.
Yeah, we're literally, as soon as I leave here, I'm going to grocery shopping.
Oh, where are you going to do that?
All over. We have a few friends in the area, too, that did a little ordering for us, you know, because I got to make 600 biscuits by Friday. So I got a lot of flour to find, and we got some chicken being shipped in. We got to get chicken brined and so on. So we got a few things to do for that event. And then Sunday, our sister restaurant, Kong River House, which is Northern Thai, which is down in South Beach as well, is doing an event at Budokan as well. So yeah, the 50 Eggs brand, we have a couple different.
How many restaurants?
We have currently technically 4, and we are very aggressively pursuing 6 and 7, or I should say 5 and 6. But yeah, we have Yardbird, we have Kong River House, and we have Swine. I'll let you figure out what Swine's all about. Like I said, the company's growing, and ultimately I'll hopefully be kind of helping drive the business and on all fronts.
That's great.
So.
Well, it's been wonderful to have you here today. You're a busy man.
Yeah.
Got to let you go. Get on top of it.
Yeah, I got some chicken to fry.
Yeah, you do. Well, thanks a lot, and thanks for listening.
It's Dorothy Cann Hamilton. I want to do a shout out to Jack Inslee and Robin Cohen, our producers. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.